most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Thursday, November 8th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us here at Normal to help us end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org to make your donation or join Normal today. So tonight in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, at the Pennsylvania College of Technology, I'll be presenting a lecture on marijuana legalization. If you happen to be out in the far northeast of Pennsylvania tonight, you can find out more information about that on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. So since I'm on the road today, we're going to listen in to some of the legislative panel that took place at the Normal 2007 conference in Los Angeles. The panel is called Marijuana Law Reform 2007, State Legislative Reforms and Future Efforts. The panel was chaired by Normal's senior policy analyst, Paul Armentano, and included Mickey Norris of California, Josh Schimberg of Texas, Allison Holcomb of Washington, Keith Strupp of Normal in Washington, D.C., Jesse Stout from Rhode Island, Ray Warren from the Marijuana Policy Project, and Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance. We won't get to all the speakers today, but the complete panel is available on the Normal Events podcast. You can link up to it at www.norml.org/podcast.
On the subject of marijuana use and psychomotor impairment. He's the author of a 2005 report entitled You're Going Directly to Jail, DUI Legislation, What It Means, Who's Behind It, and Strategies to Prevent It. He is also respected as a leading authority on the subject of drug testing, as well as the medical properties of cannabinoids. In 2007, Paul authored the booklet Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids, a review of the recent scientific literature, and I believe each of you should have gotten a copy of that in your materials when you signed up. Paul has previously served as a consultant to several international research organizations, including GW Pharmaceuticals in England and Health Canada on various health-related issues. We're very proud of Paul's work. Paul Armentano.
Thank you. We've got a full panel, so I'm going to keep my opening remarks as quick as I can, but I did want to make a few comments on state legislative efforts, and particularly those efforts this past year. In 2007, there were a record number of marijuana law reform bills introduced in more than two dozen states. And as the presenters here are going to tell you shortly, many of these efforts were in fact successful. Having worked in this movement now, as Keith said, for more than a decade, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, and I'm sure the panelists will agree with me, there is probably nothing harder to do than to shepherd a piece of legislation through a legislature and get it passed in the law. This process is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And a lot of the groundwork that was a lot of the groundwork that led to the passage of the bills we're going to talk about up here this year was actually laid years previously, and it's just now bearing fruit. The reason that these efforts are now yielding fruit, I think, is a real testament to both the maturation of this issue and the sophistication of the drug law reform movement. There's no doubt that experience breeds success, and many of us up here now have been doing this for a number of years. We have quite a bit of experience now on this issue. And as a movement, we've grown. We've gained the trust of a number of the legislators we work with. They know that the information we give them is factual and that it's scientific. And we've built up long-standing relationships now with these legislators, and we are beginning to see those relationships paying off. We've also learned as a movement how to better coordinate our efforts and to make our voices heard. For example, this past year, Normal supporters sent over 15,000 letters this spring to their state elected officials in different states, including 2,000 letters from members in New Mexico to their legislature in favor of New Mexico's new medical marijuana law. In Texas, we had supporters send over 1,200 correspondences to their politicians in favor of decriminalization and a bill that you're going to hear more about imminently. We worked as a coalition, not just with the groups being represented on this stage, but also with a number of small grassroots organizations on the ground in these states. And in states where we did not have legislative success in 2007, we planted the seeds and we've watered them for successes in 2008 and beyond. We've got a decorated panel here to talk about the state legislative successes we had in 2007. As many of these individuals will tell you, these changes did not take place overnight. They were the result of, in many cases, multi-year campaigns. In some cases, they were even divisive campaigns on the ground. And I'm sure many people will have questions about some of those campaigns, and hopefully we'll have time for you to ask those questions and for us to answer them. But now I want to go right to the panel and have the individuals who are most closely related to many of these state legislative successes talk about them. I'm going to begin by having a discussion about the state of Texas. As some people here may know, this past summer, the legislature in Texas decided to address prison overcrowding, and they realized that one of the easiest and most efficient ways to do that would be to address the senseless arresting and criminalizing of adults who possess small amounts of marijuana. As Steve Dillon said earlier, 89% of all Americans arrested on marijuana charges are arrested for simple possession. That's actually not the case in Texas. If you look at 2005 data, there were 63,000 Texans arrested on marijuana charges. 97% of individuals in Texas were charged with simple possession, much higher than the national average. Beginning in September, a new law was passed that says local law enforcement now have the discretion to no longer arrest individuals who are found in possession of up to 4 ounces of marijuana. Instead, they can issue them simply a citation. This is actually a big deal because under Texas law, an individual can face 1 year in jail and a $4,000 fine if they're arrested for possessing marijuana. So certainly this this is an improvement, but as I noted, it is up to the discretion of law enforcement. And what our presenter, Josh Schimberg from Texas Normal, is going to talk to us about today is both how this law got passed and how, since it's been passed, it appears to being how it is being enacted. Josh Schimberg is the executive director of Texas Normal, based out of Austin, Texas. He is the new executive director, although he's been involved in drug law reform now for about 3 years. He was one of the point persons in the passage of a SAFER initiative at the University of Texas at Austin. He has testified before the state legislature. In fact, I know he testified in favor of ending the arrests of adults who possess small amounts of marijuana this past summer. And he's doing some really terrific work in Texas. And at this time, I'd like to bring him to the stage to talk to us about this recent reform in the state of Texas that is long overdue.
Thank you, Paul, and I want to thank everybody who showed up for the Normal Conference. This is my first conference, and I'm really happy to be here. I'm jumping in head first, and I'm happy to be talking about this bill that was passed. I'm going to give some general background information on how and why HB 2391 was passed and exactly what the bill is about, and then I'm going to talk about how or if it's going to be implemented around the state. As Paul noted, Texas is horrible. As far as the justice system, and especially with respect to marijuana arrests. According to the United States Bureau of Justice statistics, Texas has the second highest incarceration rate in the nation, which puts its incarceration rate above most countries in the world, including the United States. Each arrest, as we all know, takes a police officer off the street for several hours, and it can cost upwards of $10,000 in combined cost if you add up the police time, the justice systems, and the penal system as far as incarceration. According to the Texas Commission on Jail Standards, 10% of all Texas inmates right now are pre-trial misdemeanor defendants, meaning that they're sitting in jail waiting on a trial for a misdemeanor offense. Texas jails are overflowing right now statewide, whether it's in Bexar County in San Antonio, Dallas County up in Dallas and Fort Worth area. Many rural jails are overflowing. HB 2391 was originally meant for all or most Class B misdemeanors. The language that was put together was mostly worked on by a group called Texans for Public Safety Solutions. It's a nonprofit organization that was started specifically to pass bills like this to save Texas taxpayers money and to clear up jail space. Texans for Public Safety Solutions got a grant from a couple of different organizations in the nation. They have not gone publicly out and said who these grants came from, but there's reasons behind that, because if you ever go to the Texas legislature and have to deal with the politicians who work there, they're very hostile to people of our liking. If you tell them that you're there with Normal or with MPP or the ACLU or any other organization like that, they will literally tell you while you're standing up there giving testimony that they don't like you and they think what you're doing is wrong. Texas for Public Safety Solutions, however, had a primary lobbyist by the name of Susanna Hupp, who is a former Republican chairperson in the Texas legislature. And the author for the bill was also a Republican from the Dallas area, actually Plano, by the name of Representative Jerry Madden, and it was co-sponsored in the Senate by another Republican from the Amarillo area, Senator Kel Seeliger. Excuse me. The amazing thing about HB 2391 is that it passed through both the House and the Senate in Texas with almost zero votes against it. In the committees, it passed through with no votes against, and when it went to the floor, there was only one vote against the bill throughout the whole process, which was by a senator from the Houston area whose name is Dan Patrick. And if anybody knows anything about Dan Patrick, which I'm sure none of you do, Dan Patrick is a close friend of Rush Limbaugh's, who I'm sure everybody's a huge fan of. A little bit of joking there. There's a few reasons why HB 2391 passed with such near unanimous support. And a lot of it had to do with the committee chairpersons and also the authors who I just mentioned, which were Republican. The committee chairpersons for the representative, excuse me, the committee chairperson in the House for the criminal jurisprudence was Representative Aaron Pena, who is a Democrat, and he's from Hidalgo County, which is near the Mexico border. In the Senate, it went to the Criminal Justice Committee, and the chairperson there was also a Democrat by the name of John Whitmire from the Houston area. The bill's caption, which was perfect to help it pass through, had nothing to do with marijuana per se. The bill was aimed at, as I said, reducing the jail overcrowding and also at saving the taxpayers money. And the caption for the bill, as introduced and as signed by Governor Perry, read, "Relating to the appearance of certain misdemeanor offenders before a magistrate." And actually, without reading the entire bill language and looking up each individual law that it covered, you would never know that it specifically chose Class A and B misdemeanor possession of marijuana. The offenses covered under HB 2391, there's a total of six of them. It's marijuana possession, Class A and B misdemeanors. It is criminal mischief up to $500, which is a Class B misdemeanor, and that covers everything from graffiti to property damage and things like that. Also covered was theft by check up to $500, theft of service up to $500, and interestingly, bringing contraband into a correctional facility by an employee of that facility. And these were listed on the bill in the order that I read them to you. So marijuana was the top one. And another interesting fact about that is the original language was meant to include most Class B misdemeanors. However, the language was substituted by another bill or meshed with another bill that there were several people in the legislature that were working on, and they specifically chose those offenses to be on the bill, which means that somebody had the gumption to stand up and say, we need to include the marijuana arrest because, as Paul noted, more than 60,000 people are arrested every year for marijuana offenses, and more than 95% are just for possession, which is pretty outrageous. What HB 2391 does not affect is the penalties for any of these crimes. What it does is gives the officers the discretion to instead write a citation, let the offender or defendant go on their way, and it gives them a court date where they come back before the judge, and then they can be sentenced to whatever the judge deems necessary. Also, the defendant must reside in the county where the offense occurred. So let's say I travel from Austin up to Dallas and get popped for a small bag. This bill would not include me in that because I'm not in my home county. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the implementation, whether or not this is going to be implemented around the state. And as many of you know, law enforcement in Texas in general is very strict. It's pretty infamous nationwide and even worldwide with how they deal with drug offenders in particular. It seems like the legislators at the Capitol are scared to look weak on drugs or something to that effect. But what they're missing the point is a lot of the voters in Texas are conservative voters, and real conservative voters don't like wasted money, especially their tax money. They don't like big government, and they hate to see the jails overcrowding where the jail administrators have to actually move inmates in and out just to make room for new defendants. Most of the law enforcement in Texas probably won't be implementing this. The funny thing is, it really depends on which law enforcement entity and where in the state you are as to whether or not you will receive a citation or whether or not you will be arrested. I know some of these counties, nobody knows where they're at, but I'm going to name off counties and officials and what they have said publicly about this, starting with some of the worst offenders of not obeying what the legislature has passed. In Navarro County, which the home city is Corsicana, the county sheriff, Les Cotton, has said that his jail is perpetually overpopulated, and he's leaving it up to the discretion of the cops. And this is the county sheriff. But in Corsicana, the same county, the local police chief, along with the highway patrol sergeant in that area, has said that they're not changing any of their policies regarding any of the offenses listed on the bill. Likewise, in Palo Pinto County, the sheriff's department has said that they will use the discretion. And again, I go back to it depends on which entity you're being stopped by, whether it's the sheriff's, the local police, or the state troopers. Palo Pinto County, the sheriff's department says they will use the discretion. But in the county seat, Mineral Wells, the police chief has come out and said that he will not. Again, you see county sheriff saying they want to do this. Local police, for the most part, have said that they will not. Of course, you're always going to have really ignorant, short-sighted statements about how this is going to be implemented or whether it's not going to be implemented. In Midland County, the sheriff, Gary Painter, was quoted in the local newspaper as saying, if they are stupid enough to violate the law, then, quote, they are stupid enough to go to jail. I believe if you have any amount of marijuana, you should be placed in jail. Sheriff Gary Painter. Now, it's a really dumb statement to say that when the legislature and elected officials have voted for this bill and passed through with near unanimous support. Lamar County Sheriff B.J. McCoy from Northeast Texas wrote in the Paris, Texas News that they are going to jail, quote, they are going to jail no matter how much they've got, after referring to marijuana's supposed gateway effect and the dangers of addiction. I personally wrote a rebuttal to the Lamar County Sheriff, which was published in the Paris, Texas newspaper the week after, discounting all of his points and basically saying that his statements were uneducated and ill-informed. Jefferson County Sheriff G. Mitch Woods said that it, quote, seems to be a step towards decriminalizing these offenses, even though the bill does not decriminalize anything. As I said before, it doesn't change the penalties whatsoever. What it does is keep these pretrial defendants from taking up space where real criminals could be sitting. Just south of Austin, there is a county called Bexar County where San Antonio sits. The Bexar County Judge Nelson Wolf, who also happens to be a political icon in that general area, officially sent an open letter to Governor Rick Perry before the bill was passed. And basically, it was urging Governor Perry to support the bill. And Judge Wolf very conservatively estimated that Bexar County could save $10,000 per day if they would only implement the provisions of the bill that don't deal with marijuana. That's $10,000 a day for the other five. $10,000 a day saved if they implement for the other five offenses, but what he's missing is there's 63,000 people arrested for marijuana offenses in Texas. $10,000 a day adds up to something like $3,650,000 in a year. If they would implement that for the marijuana arrest, who knows how much more they could save? He didn't estimate that. The Bexar County Sheriff's Department Jail Administrator Dennis McKnight, who I personally talked to up at the legislature when I was giving testimony, has been a very outspoken proponent of this bill and other outright decriminalization bills in the legislature. Mr. McKnight has to deal with a jail, a county jail in Bexar County, that he has said to the legislature is literally overflowing on a daily basis. And what he has to do is take inmates who are sitting in jail and decide which ones are the ones that are okay to let go so he can bring in new pretrial misdemeanor defendants. And he's sick of doing it, and he hates to see, real criminals might slip through the cracks and be let out of this jail when they're putting these people in jail for nothing, basically. The San Antonio Police Department, which is also in Bexar County, as I mentioned, has been in contact with the district attorney there, District Attorney Susan Reed, who initially, before the bill was voted on and passed and signed, had indicated that she might be open to implementing the bill. However, the police department made a public statement that after consulting with DA Reed, they had decided not to implement the bill. And again, this is the local sheriff or the local police going against the county sheriff's wishes and going with the DA. Likewise, in Harris County, where Houston is, the district attorney, Chuck Rosenthal, sent a memo out to all local and county law enforcement in Harris County saying that if his office receives any cases where a citation was given for a Class B or A misdemeanor, that he's not going to accept any of those cases, which sounds kind of neat on the face of it. Well, hey, he's not going to prosecute him. That's not what he's saying to the local law enforcement. What he's saying is, you guys need to arrest these people. And what's even worse, in Harris County, coming up next month on the ballot, the district attorney Rosenthal, along with many of the county and city officials, are pushing a $300 million bond package on the voters because their jails are overcrowding and they need to build more jails. But yet, the district attorney has publicly said that he's not going to implement this when it could easily ease their jail burden by hundreds, if not thousands, of inmates every month and year. Dallas County, where Dallas is, has not made any public statements about this, but I will say they need to implement it. Earlier this year, the Texas Commission on Jail Standards forced Dallas County to release 700 prisoners outright out of their jails due to severe overcrowding. And this was something that had to be done on a week time frame. So basically, they had to take 700 people from their jail within a week and get them out because of the overcrowding issue. Fort Worth, the local police have said that they may want to implement it. This is Tarrant County. But again, the Sheriff's Department, the state troopers, and the DA have said no. Travis County, and this is the oasis in Texas where I reside, Austin. Travis County is a great place to be. The Travis County Commissioner's Court had a hearing before the bill was passed and gave their full support to this bill. They gave it the okay for implementation, and the Travis County Sheriff's Department and the constables have said publicly that they will do the same. Austin Police Department has been doing a similar type of unofficial thing for several years now for minor possession, whether it's a joint or a small baggie. Sometimes they will write people a citation for paraphernalia instead of possession, which keeps that person out of jail and lets the cops stay on the street. And of course, the Austin Police Department will be implementing this bill to the fullest. I hope that this attitude in Austin can rub off on some of the other people around the state. It's a hard thing to do. A lot of these people that have made dumb statements about this bill are elected officials, and I would like to see a publicity campaign go on in Texas where we can say, hey, your elected official in your county said that they don't want to implement something that your representative voted for, so we need to get somebody else in there. And we're trying to get more support. We're trying to push more bills, and we will not give up. We're going to keep doing it. Every legislative session, the next one's in 09. They're every 2 years. Check us out, texasnormal.org, and support any of these organizations up here. They're all great. Thank you for having me. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you, Josh. Our next speaker is Ray Warren from the Marijuana Policy Project. Ray is going to talk about a successful effort this year to expand Vermont's medical marijuana law, which was originally passed in 2004, and I think everyone would admit was the most restrictive law regarding medical marijuana on the books, and as a result, really wasn't being utilized by the population to the degree we would like to have seen it. So as a result, MPP led an effort to go back to the legislature in Vermont and reform that law, and they did a good job of doing so. Ray Warren, as I said, is the director of state policies for MPP. He is a former legislator from North Carolina who served two terms in the House, and he is also has a 7-year history as an elected North Carolina Superior Court judge. It was while he was serving as a Superior Court judge that he came to the conclusion that the war on drugs, the way we are fighting it, is a failure, and particularly the war on marijuana is being fought in a way that is detrimental to the public, and that led him to begin this new stint of his career at MPP in coordinating these sort of state lobbying efforts. So please give a warm welcome to Ray Warren.
Thank you, Paul, and thanks to Alan and Keith and Paul for having us here. We really appreciate that. I am from North Carolina. I still live in the South because I live in Virginia, just outside of the district. But I don't have an accent. So I did want to talk to you a little bit about Vermont, and I'm going to take 2 seconds just to be a little bit off topic there and say, in response to Josh's excellent presentation, one of the things we've discovered recently, or we really came to our mind after Texas passed this law, is a lot of states already have catch and release statutes on the books. They're just not being used. For example, you can do that in North Carolina. For a misdemeanor, you can arrest somebody and cite them to court rather than arrest them. You can do that in Iowa. So one of the things we may want to look at, and then I'm going to get to the topic I'm supposed to talk about, is having local police departments, particularly in liberal jurisdictions, adopt as their policy to use existing state laws, because a lot of states already have this, and it's a very underutilized option. It's sort of decrim light because, in fact, for first offenses for small amounts, the amount of time people spend in jail is usually that pretrial arrest period. So if we could eliminate that, we could eliminate the jail time. But anyway, let's talk about Vermont. As Paul said, Vermont did have the most restrictive of the medical marijuana laws. And I had to write down these notes because I have a great staff of three legislative analysts, and I let them handle all the details, and I do the big stuff, and then I get invited to a conference, and I have to have the details. But initially in Vermont, the law was, I believe, 2 ounces, one plant, and two immature plants. One mature plant, two immature plants. We had three conditions named, HIV, cancer, and MS. No intractable pain, no nausea, no wasting, except in relation to, say, HIV or cancer. We only had about, I believe it was 30 patients enrolled in the program. So, working with the local activists, including the local normal chapter, we went back to the legislature to say improve this law. Now, I think it is important to emphasize here how staying, as Paul said earlier, and keeping these relationships is important. When the law was passed in 2004, I know MPP spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was a major arm-twisting event. It was before my time, but I've been told stories about it. We had to put pressure on legislators. It was very, very difficult. This last time, the bill was so uncontroversial that we don't have a recorded vote on the floor in the chambers because they did it by voice vote. We do have recorded committee votes, and we do know that we got Republican as well as Democratic votes. It was very bipartisan. So what happened was, in 2004, we had to fight the hard fight. We got the law passed. 2 or 3 years went by, and the world did not end in Vermont. And this was very important. So when Jesse Stout talks about Rhode Island, I think he'll show you the same thing. Rhode Island passed a bill, had a one-year sunset. Thanks to Jesse and the great activists in Rhode Island, we were able to get the sunset removed this year. So sometimes we have to go with these restrictive bills. I know everybody hates them because it's really stupid when you've got people who are suffering. Sometimes we have to do that, but we don't leave them at that. If we can just show that the world does not end, then we can go back and improve the bills. And in this case, in both Vermont and Rhode Island, legislators have touched marijuana, figuratively, twice, and nobody's died. So that's a good sign. So what we did, we went into the bill, we wanted to increase the plant limit, which one and two is obviously not capable of supporting the needs of patients. We knew that patients were either growing an illegal amount or going to outside sources. We had hoped to get the plants count up to as many as 18 immature plants. In the process of going back and forth, we ended up with 2 mature and 7 immature, which I think is still inadequate, but is a great improvement over 1 and 2. We also got the legislature to drop the card fee from $100 to $50. Now, one of the things that really helped us, and I always say if you're going to have legislation in the initial stages, is the Department of Public Safety, and that's what's really interesting about Vermont. In a lot of states, the health department manages the medical marijuana program. In Vermont, it's basically the police, the Department of Public Safety, has control over the medical marijuana program. They were mandated in the original legislation to issue a report saying, did this cause problems? Did this create issues with law enforcement? It really helped us that the report showed that it did not. And I think Jesse may mention that same thing sort of happened in Rhode Island. We know that, generally speaking, a good medical marijuana law is not going to cause law enforcement issues. So one of the things I always like to put in legislation is to have them do a report a year or two later. Because we can say it's working, but it's always helpful when the state government itself says it's working. We were very fortunate in Vermont to have really good patients on the ground. Mark Tucci, who is a published author, was sort of an expert on Grow Your Own and was able literally to sit down with these legislators in committee hearings and say why you can't get enough medical marijuana off one mature plant. We had a great patient, Steve Perry, who actually came to us through the assistance of the local normal chapter. Steve had intractable pain. He has ruptured disc. He also has degenerative joint disease, simply not covered by the current Vermont law at that time. It's really important if you have a real live patient who would benefit from the changes that you want to bring forth. And we had a really good medical witness, Dr. McSherry, and other doctors who were willing to come forward. Now, one of the things we were concerned about was Governor Douglas, who's a Republican. For some strange reason, New England's very Democratic but loves to elect Republican governors. We had the same issue in Rhode Island. Governor Douglas had let the 2004 bill go into effect without signing it or vetoing it, just letting it go into effect. We didn't know if he would do that this time. Fortunately, in the end, he did, but we had to keep up the public pressure on him to make sure he didn't veto it for whatever political reasons. And as you know, when you have a Republican governor like Governor Douglas in Vermont or Governor Cacheri in Rhode Island, they actually get a lot of pressure from a certain resident at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So it was really something to be able to keep Governor Douglas from vetoing the bill because we know he did hear from the folks in Washington. So we did lose, we gained wasting as a condition. We gained chronic pain as a condition. We gained nausea as a condition. And the conditions no longer have to be terminal. We did not gain glaucoma. We had that in there. And I guess another lesson is in a small state, one person can make a difference, good or bad. We had an optometrist in the legislature who just insisted that this was not the best treatment for glaucoma, so we had to give up glaucoma in that case. What we came out with was two mature plants, seven immature plants. The amount is 2 ounces of usable, which we think is still inadequate. But the plant limit went up and the conditions went up. Now, how has this affected Vermont? Well, as I said, when we started this legislative process, there were 30 registered patients. In the last 4 months, it's gone up to 54. So clearly, a lot of people who could benefit are now able to benefit. Now, just summarizing again in Vermont, I would say the keys are we had good patients, we had good cooperation from all of the folks who worked together on this. We had a report from state government showing no harm had happened, and we had very good medical evidence. We also had the fact that Mark Tucci, who was one of our primary on-the-ground activists, was a constituent of the sponsor, Senator Sears. So the senator had a strong interest in protecting his constituent. I have been asked maybe to mention a little bit about New York now because, although that was not necessarily on the agenda, we are also continuing to push a bill in New York. As you know, New York is the last big, thoughtful state, we like to think, that does not have a medical marijuana law at all. At this point, we have passed overwhelmingly in the New York Assembly, which is their House of Representatives. The governor, who in the campaign rather foolishly said that he was opposed to medical marijuana, has seen the light and says he will sign the bill. The Senate in New York is narrowly in the hands of Republicans, and the majority leader, Senator Bruno, tells us he's in favor of passing our bill. But the Senate has not acted on it yet. The Senate did introduce a bill that they have not acted on, which we feel would be totally ineffective because it requires New York to get involved in the distribution of medical marijuana. Labeling packages, saying who can grow, who cannot grow. We're really worried about federal preemption there. We want to move at some point towards dispensaries regulated dispensaries in several states. We have a dispensary bill provision in our Illinois bill. In Minnesota, there's a bill that will be taken up by the House of Representatives this year. It passed four Senate committees last year. It passed several committees in the House. It's ready for House action, and it's dispensary only. It doesn't even have grow your own. But when you do dispensaries, you have to be very careful. Remember, all the state can do is remove its own penalties. The state can't become the dispensary. Otherwise, you're going to have the DEA go right to federal court, and there goes the dispensary provision. So we're fighting in New York. The senators say they're in favor of it. We commissioned a poll of conservative party members. As you may know, in New York, there's four or five, six political parties. A lot of Republicans run on the Republican line. They also run on the conservative line, and you get to combine those votes. So the conservative party vote is an important part of the base of any elected Republican in New York. We polled conservative party members and found 54% were in favor of the medical marijuana law. We also polled Republicans in seven key Senate districts held by Republicans, and the support for the medical marijuana bill was between 52 and 76% for Republicans. So we've done a lot to try to convince Republicans this is okay, you need to do this. The legislature is not technically in session now, but we have every hope they will come back for a special session this fall. If any of you are from New York, please track me down at this conference. I'd love to talk to you. But the whole key in New York now is getting the Senate to move, simply getting them to move. They say they're in favor. The Assembly has passed it. The governor says he'll sign it. What we would like to do in New York is keep grow your own, because we know that works. That's what the other 12 states use. We also are willing to put a provision there that says the Senate provision that says New York can ask the federal government, may we be involved in distribution of medical marijuana? And if the federal government says yes, then grow your own will go away. But we feel like that's a win-win because it allows the senators to say we're trying to do it with a state system, but it also protects the patients in case the federal government says no. It was an exciting year in Vermont. It's exciting right now in New York. I want you to know I really think we have a chance sometime before the next election cycle to make New York the 13th medical marijuana state. But it's all based on years and years of work. As Paul said, you just can't do this the first year. The way we were able to advance the law further in Vermont and the way Jesse was able to do it in Rhode Island was building on those relationships we built. So right now we have bills in Illinois. Last year didn't quite pass, but we're keeping those relationships. We'll be back this year. We fell just a few votes short in New Hampshire. We'll be back in New Hampshire this year. I look forward to working with all of you. As you know, I'm sort of new to the movement. I would love to meet as many of you as possible, and I thank you for having me here.
We've been listening to audio from the Normal 2007 conference. We just heard panel audio from the Marijuana Law Reform 2007 State Legislative Reforms and Future Efforts panel, chaired by Normal's Senior Policy Analyst, Paul Ermentano. The complete panel is available on the Normal Events podcast. Just visit www.norml.org/podcast. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.